This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease. And the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
Wearing a Men's Warehouse outfit makes you confident, like you could do anything, so you dance like no one is watching, even though everyone is watching. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit, you interview like the job is already yours because it is. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit, you golf as if the rules don't apply to you because you're too well-dressed for rules. Because of the Men's Warehouse outfit. At Men's Warehouse, get measured, get fitted, get hot, get confident in everything from tailored suits to underwear and all the stuff in between. Love the way you look at Men's Warehouse.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker Daily. My name is Ian Dunt. I'm the editor of politics.co.uk and the author of How to Be a Liberal. I'm joined today by a titan of British broadcasting, the former host of Question Time and the man who anchored TV coverage of some of the biggest occasions in national life, David Dimbleby. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. I mean, every day is exactly the same as every other day and it involves me staring at my dining room because I'm not allowed to go anywhere else. But apart from that, pretty good.
So how do you know what's going on in the world? Through television? Through how do you access all this? How have you been following the American elections? How are you following?
I feel like I'm betraying you by saying this, but I've gone to CNN. So the American elections were exclusive CNN territory for me. And so for about a week straight, I injected that stuff into my eyeballs and I'm now weaning myself off this terrible drug. How about you?
I'm slightly surprised by that. I thought, I watched ITN on the night quite a lot because I thought they had a very good studio setup and Tom Bradby was really good. But CNN, the one thing about CNN, I mean, I like CNN and I did some stuff with Christiane Amanpour just before the election. But on the election stuff, I was surprised, put it like this, that on election night and subsequently, they've got one Republican. And for my money, if you're going to cover the thing properly, they ought to have had a Republican voice being challenged about what Trump was saying. Instead, they were all sort of singing to the same hymn tune, you know, hymn sheet, you know, all saying, oh, this is ridiculous. I thought it was just, not that it was one-sided. I mean, it wasn't that. It was just that it was monotonously one-sided.
Yeah, I thought there's a bit of that in the days that followed. But on election night itself, I didn't really, they sort of gave up on the pundits altogether and just went for some kind of frenzied.
Oh, I love that guy with the beard. Wolf, what's his name? He's brilliant.
He is very good. But also just the sheer commitment to data rather than any kind of commentary at all, which lasts for about 24 to 48 hours where they just sit in front of a screen. And if, I think if you're a sort of like hardcore political nerd, on the night itself, that's probably what you're looking for.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. That's all there is in an American election result, isn't it? There are no candidates talking. There's nothing like British election nights are absolutely brilliant. I think they're the best election nights in the world because our voting system, which is attacked as being completely outrageous, and in many ways it is, actually, on election night, it's a proper horse race. It really works. Mm-hmm. And you get excitement and you get the candidates gradually dawning on them what's happened, you know, over Brexit as well, over the referendums. I've always kind of compared it to, it's like political archaeology. It's like being a political archaeologist presenting it. You sort of go into the studio and at 5 to 10, you have an exit poll. And then the first results come in and it's like being involved on a very complex dig at Mycenae or somewhere where you have an empty field and you just dig away and you find a little bit of little bit of pottery and you say, ah, that shows that, and then gradually a picture emerges. Whereas American elections, you know, it's exciting, and watching Georgia was absolutely riveting, but nobody knows what's happened for so long, and nobody comes out and looks sad, disappointed, you know, well, certainly not Trump. Whereas in a British election, you get that wonderful, the downcast look. You remember the look on Portillo's face when he lost way back. I remember it well. Like that, yeah.
I remember it well. It was one of my first nights of sort of watching politics. And I remember my mum jumping up and down on the bed in just absolute euphoric glee.
Hang on. Your mum was jumping up and down on your bed? On her own bed.
My parents on that night were in Winchester. And if you remember, Winchester went to the Lib Dems by 2 votes.
I do remember well. And they had a re-thing, didn't they?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so it was a very euphoric night in the Dunt household that right. evening. Yeah, right. You've just brought out a new podcast looking at the Iraq War years called the Fault Line: Bush, Blair, and Iraq. What made you go back to this stuff particularly right now?
Podcasting's really interesting, and the Iraq War podcast sort of illustrates this, which is that if you go back to things that have happened, what are we talking about, 17 years ago? People talk about them in a much more nuanced way, and you get reflections on how things happened, which in the heat of the moment don't come through. And what really interested me about it, and I think is fascinating about it, is the central business. It's called Bush, Blair, and Iraq. The central feature of the podcast is the relationship between Bush and Blair, which actually means, in an odd way, the relationship created by Blair with Bush, which got us into the war. And what I think is stunningly and intriguing about this is that you have Blair as a kind of idealist, which he was. He made this speech in Chicago when Clinton was still president, talking about the democracies in the world, creating democracies where they could and all that sort of thing. So he thinks immediately after 9/11 that the proper place for Britain is beside America, and then gets involved in this idealistic view that you've got to get rid of Saddam, and nobody thought Saddam was anything other than an extremely wicked, dangerous, unpleasant dictator. But then gets sucked into trying to persuade Britain and his electorate, because unlike America, who, you know, they actually passed a law under Clinton saying that regime change in Iraq was American policy, in quotes, whatever that means, doesn't mean they were going to do anything about it. But in Britain, invading a country and unseating the dictator is not allowed legally, though we certainly have done it from time to time. And so he has to find a way of justifying what he believes is the right course to take. And so you get into this business of, does Saddam Hussein have weapons of mass destruction? And that's where it all becomes completely fascinating, because at every turn there are moments when doubt is cast on whether he does have WMD. Remember, he had them after the first Gulf War, and the weapons inspectors concluded he got rid of them after the first Gulf War under the inspection regime. The question was whether he was still making them. And then all sorts of people come out with an axe to grind, if that's not the wrong word, analogy to use. But anyway, people come out saying, yes, of course he's got weapons of mass destruction. And who are they? They're people who want to unseat him, like Shalaby, who wants to become president, various people. And so false information starts coming out saying he has got weapons of mass destruction. And there's a counter-argument that actually he hasn't. But Blair can't really hear that, because he's already committed himself as a major diplomatic act to support George W. Bush. And so what we're showing is in this is how, when the facts start to turn against you, if you're committed to a course of action politically, you find it very difficult to abandon the path you've set yourself, the course you've set yourself. if ambiguity comes in, if doubt comes in, your instinct is to push it to one side. And of course, fatally, at the end, they accepted the evidence, and even Colin Powell, who was speaking at the UN at the very end about this, they accepted the evidence of a charlatan, who turned out later to be a total, total charlatan, who said that there were mobile lorries going around in Iraq making chemical weapons. And it was a it wasn't a fantasy, it was a lie, which he'd invented, and which he kept on, you know, finding ways of feeding information suggesting it was true. Now, when that came through, what happens? Well, it could be true, may not be true, but it spoils the story, the narrative of what we're on, the course we've set on. 45,000 British troops already in southern Iraq, waiting to go in outside southern Iraq, waiting to go into battle. You know, you at that moment, do you hesitate because of this information? And he didn't. He ignored it. If you're a politician and you decide on a course and you've got huge political capital invested in it, what is it that can knock you off course? And the answer is it's very, very difficult to be knocked off course, because politics being what it is, that would look like feebleness, weakness, that would damage your relationship internationally, damage your relationship with America and all the rest of it. That's really what this podcast is about.
There's a temptation, isn't there, to sort of mark this moment as the beginning of the sort of decline in trust in, you know, in government, in media, that sort of leads you then to, you know, the referendum on Brexit and Donald Trump and things like that. Is that too pat, or do you think there's something to it?
Well, I think it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, as a journalist, one has a terrible tendency to pat about things. I think, you know, it's easy to make, to string those things together. I don't know what the causation consequences of it were, but I think certainly it did demonstrate and illuminate and put a spotlight on, if you like, a feeling that, first of all, the word of politicians couldn't be trusted. When Blair stood up and said 45 minutes, you know, the threat and all that, and we've got to do this, and made analogies with appeasement of Hitler in the House of Commons and got a huge majority in the House of Commons, and then it turns out that the arguments he was using all through were untrue, I think that certainly damaged the trust in politicians. As for the journalism in America in particular, the big newspapers swallowed the line that was being put out by the intelligence services, not always by the CIA, funnily, because they subverted the CIA off and went round the back and came up with stories about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. And those weren't properly investigated. I mean, the Knight Ridder organization, which we talked to, which was a federation of smaller newspapers, they thought it stank, and they did investigate. But, you know, the big newspapers actually swallowed the line that Saddam had these weapons of mass destruction. So on that front, I think that was damaged. And as for the intelligence services, well, the intelligence services actually were guilty, I think, if guilty is perhaps a strong word, but anyway, at the very end, they were guilty actually of kind of massaging their own information under political pressure. I mean, I think that's certainly, when you read carefully what Chilcot said about the weapons of mass destruction, the abolition of the word may have, imminent threat, may pose, you know, all that may being turned under political pressure from number 10 into has weapons of mass destruction, does pose a threat. So I think all three, yes, certainly took a knock. And whether that, you know, I'm not a social scientist. I wouldn't go into the business of whether that affected the Brexit vote. I mean, maybe the Brexit vote was affected because, you know, Labour didn't come strongly out in favour of Remain. I don't know. It could be all sorts of causes for that. I think that's a different matter. That was the first time I remember as a teenager. And I remember the division about whether we should go in with the French to unseat Nasser from nationalising the Suez Canal when, you know, afterwards it turned out that we had colluded with Israel, and it turned out equally that the Americans had threatened to destroy the value of the pound, and that's what led us to stop. Now, that argument certainly was a polarizing argument. In fact, I remember the two church wardens at our village church actually had to be separated from coming to blows over the issue.
Oh, my.
Yeah, when you get the church divided, you know, you're... And so certainly over that, that was true. And certainly, yes, over the miners' strike and indeed over Margaret Thatcher's monetarist policies and the unemployment and over the poll tax, people hurling scaffolding poles in Trafalgar Square. No, I think we forget too easily. I had a friend, a political friend, when the poll tax riots were going on. He said, oh, you want to call this a riot? You want to look back to the Bristol riots in whenever it was, 1850 or the chase the Bishop of Bristol over the roofs of the cathedral. And, that, you know, I think polarization is what happens. I mean, that's what happens in politics. I mean, I know you're famously a sort of centrist, but I imagine you get angry and you get frustrated and you do take a hard line. I mean, being a centrist can be just as hard line as being on the left or the right. That true? I think so.
I'm not in any position to comment on that. I don't really consider myself a centrist, although lots of people say that to you.
I thought you were.
No, no, not at all. No, lots of people certainly say it. But you're right. I mean, ultimately, if one was to have a sort of absolute centrist position over the last few years, let's say if you're, well, I mean, you know, Alistair Campbell or something, which pretty much defines that view, then, you know, in the period of Corbyn and sort of Theresa May, Brexit, Boris Johnson, then that would be a form of polarization in itself, right?
No, but I mean, the question about division, political divisions, and whether they get healed, or it's a social sciences question. And I was doing a debate with Essex University social sciences yesterday, and talking about the way in which opinion coalesces round a view and then becomes extreme, and whether it then, you know, whether it can be diffused, in that, for instance, whether Trump supporters will, under Biden's sort of blandishment of "I want to bring the country together and heal the country," whether that will have any effect. And there was an American guy on it, and he was, you know, quite rightly pointing out that you can try and change people's views, but it's mad to just assume that things will heal, that divisions, political divisions, after all, are lifeblood. Our political decisions about what our lives are about, what we want for our children, what we want for our country, what we want for ourselves. They're very ferocious, aren't they? You know, and it's true at the top of society as much as the bottom. The top protecting itself, and the bottom, you know, floundering on universal benefit in tower block flats with one bedroom and being told to stay in it for, you know, 3 months. I mean, of course politics is ferocious, yes. So going back to the fault line, I think what we were saying was that this illustrates, perhaps, as well as is an example of, the political division and the ferocity of the argument and the distrust about what we're told, all of which, of course, has been exacerbated by social media to an extraordinary extent. I mean, social media is far more powerful than political gossip used to be, I think. Though I've no doubt in the coffee houses of the 18th century, you heard just as much scurrilous and scandalous stuff as you do on social media.
I mean, do you feel, I mean, you're arguably, there's almost no one in this country who's sort of got more experience of the public debating politics than you. Do you feel like we're in a qualitatively different place right now in this period, in the post-social media period, than we have been in the sort of years and decades preceding it, in the manner in which we debate each other?
I think in a way, yes, because social media provides the megaphone, and that the volume is up all the time. You can't speak quietly on social media. You have to speak angry and convinced and certain, and doubt and hesitation and moderation are not read. Nobody cares about it. It's the aggression that counts on any side of any argument. So I suppose social media has helped. But you say my experiences of public opinion, well, Question Time I did for 25 years on BBC, but obviously before that I was a reporter. So I mean, my work has always been just listening to people and talking to people. And in the time on Question Time, it certainly got rougher at certain points. But again, I think it's at particular points. I mean, I remember when I began doing it, was John Major was still Prime Minister, and there was a groundswell of opposition to the Conservatives, which led to 97 and Blair's victory. And that was coming through in our audiences in Question Time. And Conservative MPs were always briefed, as they always have been, to say that the Question Time audience is biased to the left, which is rubbish. I mean, we always took terrific care to get the audience balanced. But I remember one night, we used to have a sort of supper after the program, and a Conservative MP, I can't remember who it was on the panel, and he said afterwards, I realize that actually that's not an unbalanced audience. What we're seeing is the Conservatives turning against us. And this had been because there'd been ferocious attacks on John Major from the audience. And he'd sussed out that these weren't just Labour supporters or Liberal Democrat supporters or, you know, anarchists or whatever. These were Conservatives turning against John Major, alleging incompetence and wanting him out, which in the end, of course, led to the 97 Blair victory. So that was one moment. The second moment was when the expenses scandal broke. And you remember the Daily Telegraph began revealing,
of course,
that people had spent money. We were, I think, in Grimsby when Margaret Beckett was accused, or when it was revealed by the Telegraph that she'd had some quite small sum of money spent on flower baskets for her house in her constituency. And two women at the front said, "Are you going to give the money back?" And she blushed slightly and bridled and said, "No," because all these MPs had been told, I mean, there were one or two egregious exceptions, but they'd all been told to massage their expenses because it was thought that their salaries couldn't be increased. So she thought she'd done nothing wrong. And anyway, she said no. And there was an absolute explosion from the audience of fury about that. And that went on for several weeks, really angry audiences about MPs' expenses and treating MPs with contempt. You know, it was like a sort of hanging. It was like pillorying them. If they'd been given eggs, they'd have thrown them. Well, somebody did once throw something, but it was a ham sandwich in it against the government. He was on his own on Question Time for some reason. We were in Brighton, I remember. He'd been defending his first, second, third, fourth year, whatever it was. And somebody at the back at the end, so frustrated, threw. We used to give the audience ham sandwiches and tea. Was BBC Hospitality. It was slightly stale bread and sort of old ham. This person at the back threw this sandwich and it parted in midair. So it went three ways. The top layer of the bread went one way, the bottom the other, and the ham landed at Blair's feet, my and Blair's feet. I don't think I ate it, but it was just anyway, that was anger. But then, of course, over Brexit, yes. I mean, that really became ferocious. Particularly after the referendum. I mean, it was quite fierce before the referendum, but after the referendum, you had just half the audience just shouting, get it done, as though somehow you could wave a wand and be out of the EU like that and they'd have their brave new world. So the debate was very polarized. I think it's getting more polarized. I think it's encouraged by social media. I think we're seeing, you know, the evidence of QAnon, I notice, has gone quiet, apparently, in America after Trump's defeat, which is weird. I don't know why. But anyway, the idea of conspiracies. I was reading this morning only in the paper about, believe it or not, Totnes in Devon, a place I know very well. You know, people not wearing masks and because of COVID and posting stuff about vaccines being dangerous and people believing that a vaccine would inject you with little tiny I don't know what, bits of something or other that would allow you've taken over and controlled. In Totnes, I mean, I know Totnes has a liberal reputation, but this was a conspiracy reputation in Totnes. It's rather strange going on, and they hold rallies if the story is true. I mean, I read it in the paper. I haven't been down there. I'm not allowed to go there at the moment, so I don't know what's going on. But there is a kind of madness taking over. But I think there are enough sane people around to, you know, remain fairly level-headed.
What do you think makes a sort of a good healthy argument, sort of an argument where you actually get somewhere? I mean, over the years, what kind of things have you noticed that happen that make an argument worthwhile, that means that there's progress, or alternatively, the kind of things that lead it to degenerate into just sort of, you know, angry shouting matches?
When both sides listen, simple as that. When I have ferocious arguments occasionally with people, I'm not listening properly, but I always accuse the other person of not listening to what I'm saying. I think just listening and learning from what people say. I abhor arguments that just become shouting matches. I mean, you know, we have them occasionally in my own family over politics, but I can't bear that. But then maybe I'm sort of a mealy-mouthed listener instead of somebody imbued with passion for what I think should be.
So can we expect more podcasts from you in the future?
You know, I'd really love doing them. I mean, it's a very interesting broadcasting form or art form, because it's quite unlike, it's obviously unlike television, but it's unlike radio. That's what I've discovered, that to make a podcast successful, you have to whisper into people's ears effectively about what you're saying and not be strident. And so on the professional side, I just find it really interesting to do. As for subject matter, I think there's a wealth of material out there, which I would love to do if I can, you know, you have to find the right producer. The work is all done in the production. I mean, the amazing skill of the people who edit these things and who, you know, make it easy on the ear with not too much music, little bit of music, little traces. So it's like a conversation, traces of words and argument and all that. That's very, very skilled, much underestimated. And a lot of podcasts really sort of plonk along because they haven't got that facility or felicity as well. And I think the thing I've enjoyed about, I did one on Rupert Murdoch called The Sun King before this one. And this one, The Fault Line, is it's a kind of masterwork of production. And leave aside what I do in it, it just is so fascinating. And it's so, it coaxes you into the story and draws you in. And I've got people saying, you know, can't wait for the next one, can't wait for what it reveals. That's what's exciting about it. It's just a different form of broadcasting. So I hope there'll be more coming along that way.
David, thank you very much indeed. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much for listening. That was your Bunker Daily. More of that every day of the week, as the name rather suggests, alongside the main show. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay safe.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Ian Dunt. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronijevic. An audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.